conference sponsored by Torah Masara and the Association of Jewish Day Schools of Greater Baltimore. Welcome to Beis Yaakov. My name is Robert Friedman, and his wife and myself. We welcome you all to Beis Yaakov. I'm sure you'll have an enjoyable day. Usually Rabbi Meister should be up here. For whatever reason, I lost, and Rabbi Meister said that I should be welcome. Welcome. You're privileged and honored to have such chashuv a guest. To this conference. Captivating and inspiring Talmidim for both the ideal and the real world. That's the topic of Rav Yansky's address, which we'll present in a few moments. Inspiring, inspiration. I would imagine if we think to ourselves, why in the world did we go into chinuch? Was it simply to deposit information to a group of boys, a group of girls? Or was it really to touch our students' lives, to inspire? I would venture to say that most of us would say we came into this profession to inspire, to affect a child's life, to determine their children, the children's children, to touch the child's life. And so often we lose focus on our mission. Are we inspired? Or are we just depositors of information? And inspiration is hard, because only the inspired can inspire. And how do I remain inspired? Because life is tough. There's so many things to do in our own lives. How do we inspire? And how do I remain inspired? This morning, every day in Shema, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us how we have to inspire. You had brought Ma'ela Asher Adochim Yitzhakho Hayom Al Levodacha. It is Al Levodacha, then Bishinan of Levodacha. Only if the Dvorim are Al Levodacha, not just Bilvorim, but Al Levodacha, can we hope to inspire the Ramakan Bishinan of Levodacha. It's a good COVID for us to have Rav Lavyansky here. Rav Lavyansky is the Rosh Beis Medrash of Yeshiva Gedolah of Greater Washington. Rav Lavyansky is a Machaber Sforim. He is, simply put, a Noi Dorish of Nomi Kain. Whatever it had to do with Rav Lavyansky, you can tell his sincerity, his ability to connect with people, to connect with his Talmidim, and certainly we couldn't have found Rabbi Meister, could not have found a better person to really talk to us about captivating and inspiring Talmidim, Talmidos, for the ideal and real world. God bless you.
Good morning, the Schuss of Meister, Esther, Hanhaus, Hanfin. I was a little bit daunted by the task of speaking here, because I really don't know much about chinuch, and I'm speaking to a group of people who spent their lives being mechanech, and that's a little bit of a tough one. Rabbi Meister asked that the content have a Meisterdicker angle to it, have the Meisterdick, the results, and it's not easy. I've been teaching most of my life, but I got the finished part of it, the 15 years of Mechanchim, pretty much they're coming with pen and paper in hand to learn. So really understanding a child and understanding how to take the young budding flower and bring out the best in him isn't what I spent my life doing. You are the people that did it. It's tremendous haracha. I know the product we get. And Bimela, I will try to address a certain issue that I think is very important. I will try to sketch out something in the world for the Meister, but obviously each and every one of you knows the age group. It's a tremendous difference in ages, a tremendous difference in children. Basically, I will try to focus on the point I think needs to be addressed and some of my service, but obviously the application of it is something that each and every one of you is the professional and expert at. Let me start with two stories that made me think a lot. Since Rabbi Esther touched on inspiring and captivating part of it, I really want to put the accent on the second half of that title and speak about the tension between the ideal and the real world. I'd like to start with two stories that, and they weren't one story, but this was very typical of something that occurred at a certain point in my life and fellow Talmidim. At early 20s, we were all learning yeshiva. The yeshiva was a wonderful atmosphere in terms of learning, in terms of warmth, chesed, care, concern. Really, really had a certain idyllic quality to it. We all got married at St. Kufa, and in Eretz Yisrael, neighbors opened up together, like somebody built 100 apartments in one shot, and they become populated, you buy and you populate the area together. V'kachave, myself, my chaverim, other people moved into the apartments at the same time. For us, that transition was going from the most important decision financially we have to make until then was whether to buy schnitzel or chicken. That was basically the financial frame. All of a sudden, we were spending $100,000. It was cheap at the time, but $60,000 to buy an apartment by people that were business people. And there were two types of approaches came out, and both of them were very disturbing. There was a very naive approach, since the builder had this room, he was an honest person. So just like for my roommate, I care a lot, and I do everything for him, it's a chesed project. So they kind of had in mind, this is the Kavlan's chesed project for them. They didn't bother to get these seats, they didn't bother to bottom the price down, they didn't bother to ask, to account. It was, you know, and then, you know, when it came to Maisa, the person didn't know what they wanted from him. Tachlis, this is what they agreed upon, this is what was said. It's not a chesed project. That was one side. The other extreme, equally disturbing, were people that I knew to be wonderfully, wonderful about chesed, became literally jungle people. You're Ganev, you're this, you're that. I'll tell everybody. Somebody published an ad in a paper defaming the builder without even asking a shayla or anything, just as a tool. And basically, this person's sense was everybody out there is an animal, it's a jungle. The animal world, they deal as animals. The yeshiva doesn't. The yeshiva has that. And if both of those events, both of those extremes are very disturbing, and they were common, I would say. A similar issue that came up as people started assuming new relationships. There was somebody, an acquaintance of mine, who treated his in-laws as if they would have been his parents from birth. He treated his boss, he was working for somebody doing some writing, and he went out of his way to do tremendous chassadim for his editor. And I told him, it's not right. There are different relationships. Mixing up relationships is not healthy. And sure enough, when the person had to reject an article he'd written, he was very upset. And there was an entanglement of two relationships that should never have been entangled. And over the years, as I've been thinking about it, I guess the theme that came out to me was this tension between the ideal and the real. And I want to discuss it from Torah point of view, and then just get some sort of sense of how, as teachers, do we approach it with our students. Let's start with a Maimah Chazal. The Maral addresses it. What I'm saying is a paraphrasing of what he's saying. Doesn't quite say it in as many words, but I think the theme is there, and that will be our guideline. The Mishnah says, in a Torah, in their Haaretz, in their Haaretz, in Torah. Similarly, it says, their Haaretz, Kodmo, the Torah. The Torah, in their Haaretz, a few times when you have this meshing of Torah and their Haaretz. And let's explain what that meshing of Torah and Haaretz means. Let's give an example. Let's say I want to inspire people to climb a high mountain. So I point the mountain and it's majestic. And I show the view from the top and the shots that I took and everything describing about the mountain as poetic as I can and as full of feelings as I can possibly give. And I inspire people to climb that mountain. If I don't give them any sense of how to climb the mountain, of the road to the mountain, then what I did is worse than meaningless. I actually frustrated people. 2 years ago in the summer, I spent a week at a retreat there. It's an outreach place. It's a beautiful location in the Adirondacks. And right behind the place, there was this magnificent mountain that looked like you could just jump onto it. And I asked somebody, can you go onto the mountain? He said, sure, it's not a problem. Okay? You know, it's not a problem, it's not a problem. So one early afternoon, I tackled it. First of all, it was about 90 degrees. The slope of the mountain was approximately 90 degrees. It was full of rocks. I went upway partially, and then I had a problem knowing how to get down from that thing because it was very difficult. And it was upsetting because, I really would have liked to go up, but I didn't know how. The Maharal says Torah is supernatural. Supernatural, I don't mean mystical. I mean to ask a person to overcome his inborn midos is beyond nature. People are selfish, people want for themselves, people want to indulge. Everything about Torah is not natural. So you have Torah as the endpoint. Derech Eretz, in its broadest sense, means that literally the word Derech, it is the road within this world that gets to it. Chazal speak, when they speak of Derech Eretz, Moshe says, Chof of Derech, before Torah came to the world, that was the Derech Eretz, part of the Torah of the Avos. Derech Eretz means even within this world that is very physical and selfish, there are points that contain in themselves something spiritual, something better, and I can find the road that leads back to Gan Eden by following that pathway. Derech Eretz is a spirituality that's woven into the fabric of the world. That's their heritage. So Maral explains, to get someplace, you need to have two things. You need to have a point that you get into. If I tell you, if somebody asks me, where should I go? I tell them, well, the 95 is a great highway. It's the best highway around. Okay, but where should I go? What's the difference? It's a great highway. That's not going to, you don't go any place just because it's a nice highway. On the other hand, if I tell you Connecticut is very nice, and I don't know how to get to Connecticut, it's basically as useless as trying to take I-95 as a good road. Going any place requires having both a goal, an ideal, and a way how to get there, and an understanding of how to get there. That is in Ein Torah, Ein Derech Eretz. If there is no endpoint, if there's nothing that you're aiming for, then basically the road is useless. It's a road to where? Derech Eretz means a road cut through the land. But where is it going to? But in Ein Derech Eretz, Ein Torah, the Torah as a mountain that's majestic is great. But if you don't have a sense of how to get there, it's also useless. So Ein Torah in Eretz and Ein Derech in Torah means that it works in tandem. You've got to have a goal and you've got to have a means of getting there. And one without the other doesn't exist. that, I think, is the basic structure, so to speak, of the Torah and their heretics, of the idea of the real. So as teachers, we have a very, very difficult task. On the one hand, you're supposed to speak of the goal, the idea. You're supposed to paint the end of the road in the brightest colors, because it is. The perfect tzaddik, the perfect world, the perfect chesed, and so on, is what we're aspiring to. On the other hand, all of that is useless if you don't paint a road going. And let's focus on an example. Rebbe used to say that one of the problems with stories of Gedolim is they portray the Gedol as he is, but not as he became him. So for instance, let's take an example. We take a bunch of kids and we tell them about learning. And the Rebbe is telling them about the Vilna Goyim. The Vilna Goyim slept 2 hours a night, broken up 4 times, ate two kazesim, chazik shas, never took his mind off the learning, and so on and so forth. And the kid is really, really inspired. The kid will try it once, twice, 3 times, will fail. Inevitably, always. At that point, one of two things. We'll either decide that the stories are nonsense, and the two different things are one, or we'll decide that he's a failure. But one of the two, there's going to be an inconsistency between what's been painted as the ideal and who he is. And if he's not there, so either the goal is an illusion, it's a mirage, the man doesn't exist, or he's a failure, or he's a cripple, and there's no way around it. So there's a problem that we paint the ideal and we don't give them a map through the real world. Let me pick out something that I saw that struck me extraordinarily in what I felt had a very, very positive effect in this way. It's photocopied from a book in Hebrew called the Shvilei Rabin. Shvilei Rabin means the pathways of Rabin. It was written by a grandson of the Rabin of Rosh Hashiva. This grandson has a yeshiva himself today in Eretz Yisrael, very much in Margaret's Torah. It's a family. I will tell you a name. I have strong doubts that anyone in the audience will recognize. The name is Rav Moshe Levinsky. He was Rosh Hashiva of Rabin. There's a reason why you don't recognize the name. I see some of you are smiling, but the reason is he was overshadowed by Chafetz Chaim, who everybody saw as Rabin, even though technically Chafetz Chaim was not really a Rosh Hashiva, he wasn't that. And in the yeshiva world, people are aware of Naftali Trump, who was the known Rosh Hashiva. But there's a story to it, and they write it up, and I read it, and I said to myself, I find this a remarkable value. The story was like this. Rav Moshe Levinsky was a Goyen Olam. He was from the last Talmidim of the Lashon. He knew Kalatari Kulim, where the Chafetz Chaim needed information. Rav Moshe Levinsky was the one that he ran it by, that he asked him. Rav Moshe was the Bucky. Rav Moshe Levinsky told the Frank Paul Weiss, I heard from himself, that he had chazen Baba Kama over 1,000 times. He was an extraordinary masnid, an extraordinary learner. He was still part of the old school of learning, which didn't focus on the type of learning of Chaim used to go into the world, and the Melech Shurim were not all that popular. So people respected him, but Chafetz Chaim saw this. He felt the yeshiva was not getting quality and quantity of Talmidim needed, and instead took Rav Naftali Trump, who was a brilliant market chair. He asked for Moshe Levinsky permission to do so. He hesitated, but he gave his consent. And Rav Naftali Trump became the brilliant magnet that drew people to Rabin. And everybody in the yeshiva world, Rav Naftali Trump, the Rusha Gana, are very famous. And people know it as such. Moshe Levinsky, pretty much most people do not know. They write this up. They portray Rav Moshe's own feelings about it. I'm not going to read it in detail, it's not easy. Rav Moshe needed an extraordinary measure of emotional strength in order to be able to come to grips with giving up Rosh Hashiva for the Machfalah. His greatness and his tremendous personality gave him God's strength that was needed to be able to continue without his affecting his daily Avodas Hashem. Reb Moshe told somebody, one of his close ones, when he thinks about what happened, he began imagining, imagine if I was called up to Shemaiah, and he told me, Reb Moshe, what would you prefer? To continue being Rosh Hashiva, and then we have to remove you from this world? Or to give up the Rosh Hashiva position and to continue to live? I certainly would want to live, and I'd give up being Rosh Hashiva. These thoughts make it a lot easier on me to give up my job, Reb Moshe said. And he said, believe me, it's not a muscle. This is really giving me the strength to live. And it goes through a whole chapter of different ways. He walked by once the yeshiva, and he used to get 50, 60 bucks at a shir. The Naftali used to get 250. And he used to walk by and say, you know, it's hard for me, but Baruch Hashem, there is such a part of Torah going on. The reason what I found most profound about this chapter was that if it had not been written up, had the story gone, they took in somebody else and was very happy, learned about it and was not contaminated, and that was it, I would not get much out of the story. It's the top of the mountain, and I would, you know, it's not relevant to me. To understand that he struggled up that mountain, you're talking about something that goes to the core of someone's nefesh, the struggle with it and overcoming it. I have a roadmap, and I have a way to incorporate it. I'm not the Moshevinsky, I'm not going to be Moshevinsky, but once the word struggle is put in, and it's emphasized enough that there's a road that goes to the mountain, it becomes very meaningful to me. I want to illustrate it with a story that happened with somebody in Yeshiva Bayas. There's somebody, a wonderful boy, big master, and so on. Something's been bothering him, and there was always something, I realized something's bothering him, and I couldn't put a finger on it. And something came to my head where he let it out. And then I talking and so on. This was somebody who was a wonderful boy, very average abilities, but really used them well. He had a brother 3 years older than him, has a brother 3 years older than him, who is a super, super star. And he's been living all his life in the shadow. And he, you know, every year in school would be the same thing. Oh, great, we're getting a Goldstein. His name's not Goldstein. A Goldstein in class, phenomenal. You get the front seat, first seat number one. By the end, he had made it to the last seat. This was year after year after year. So basically, he stopped being filmed for a while and came out with it. But when someone helped try to deal with it, it went as follows. Okay, what's the problem? Well, we believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu did everything. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what he's doing. So what's there to be jealous about? Nobody should be jealous. It says Aaron, when he met Moshe Rabbeinu, was happy. Ended. No jealousy. Finished. He couldn't argue the argument, but he wasn't there. I told him, I want to tell you something. A, this is a lifetime project. You don't get rid of such deep-seated anguish like this. All the arguments, we're not talking about arguments. It's not a question of, it's not a math problem. You're talking about a person living with something that goes to the core of the neshama. I said, and it's something you'll have to struggle with. The ability to struggle with it and understand that it's a step-by-step thing is very much part of it. The first clue I want to identify is, as you portray the ideal, you have to portray the real as well. Chesed is chesed, but the person who's running the business is trying to make a profit. Understand what are the realities of the world. We're not in a world where malachim roast pigeons and pour wine for everybody. People are earning, people are working, people see things their way. Understanding the realities of the world is one important to figure. And at different ages, Talmudim have to understand it and see it. It's something that's very difficult. You can't portray chesed as the only thing in the world. It's got to be understood. There's mishpat, there's right, there's wrong. Sometimes you give more, sometimes you give less. Can I give so much? Someone once asked me, you want to do a tremendous chesed for somebody. It really was beyond what I felt he's capable emotionally for. I mean, he could do it, he would do it, but if he's an impulsive person, I told him, no. Because what's going to happen is, after you do it, you're going to be upset. And you're going to regret doing it. You're going to have kindness to that person because he can't do it back to you. He's not, no one else is going to do it to you. And instead of the chesed becoming a building block, it's going to become a very destructive feature of your relationship. So understanding, and it's a hard one because you've got to paint the ideal and you've got to paint the real, and they both have to coexist. A second nekuda along this line. The Gemara says that when you would send the person to push the Sur Lazazel off the mountain, it was hot, it was in the desert, there was mountain climbing also, so they were afraid that he would start feeling bad because of the kindness. So it says, Mikir Yerushalayim v'yimolavnos atzuk ha'rishona. Eser sukos Yerushalayim v'atzuk tishem ris shivo matzah kol mil. They had 10 little resting areas, 10 little staging areas from the where they left, from the Har Abayis, until the sukh, until the cliff where they have to push them over. Al kol sukha v'sukha onimlok. They would tell them at each booth, Harei mazon, harei mayim. There's food, there's water. Do you feel okay? If not, you're allowed to drink, you're allowed to eat, do it. Or malavnos in the sukkah, they would accompany him from sukkah to sukkah, except the last one where he didn't need to. It's not enough to tell somebody at the end of the journey there's going to be food and water. Don't worry. If you feel you're dehydrating or eating, well, as soon as you finish this, there's food and water. They have to pace step by step by step. Each one had to have a sukkah to feed the way Chazal evaluated what would be the right amount to do it. In other words, you need to understand Avodah in terms of stages. And that's very important. In other words, there are only two stages. Either when I'm jealous, I take the toy away from my brother, or I give it to him with my heart singing. There are 10 sukkahs in the middle, probably 1,000. And it's important to give people mini goals. The first thing is, I let him have it. I feel bad, it bothers me, it hurts me. What's the right thing? A second stage is, I imagine, let's say, what would he feel like? What does he think? It's not enough work is done with this. I think one of the reasons why sometimes kids get a lot when they go to psychologists. I try to think a lot about the difference between the counselor and psychologist figure and the Rebbe figure. And obviously, they overlap and overmesh. The psychologist has the ability to map out stages, and that's very helpful. People like to understand step one, step two, step three, step four, and not always in Kinnock do we have that mindset or ability. If you tell a kid, okay, if you learn really stark, you're going to have a lot of patience, you can learn well. You know, if the gap is here and there, if you tell them, okay, the first stage is when you feel bored, let's say. The second stage is you start copying some things, but not everything. And the third stage is this. If you can break it down with a mini landing, And there's reward on each stage. When I reach stage one, stage two, stage three, and so on, it makes a whole lot of difference. I thought to myself once that that's a lot of times the sharpest difference. A completely, let's call it secular psychologist, the mindset would be, he's got the road mapped out, but where it's going to, he doesn't have a total amount, you should feel good. So the road is basically taking back to yourself. It's not going anywhere. We in the Torah world have a beautiful place to approach. We're lacking a lot in the step-by-step place. I remember when I was a young boy, I was learning in a yeshiva. It wasn't who was a very liberal yeshiva in those days in high school, and I picked up her Volvo's book, the Sefer Ali Shur, and I was entranced by the fact that there's a sense of direction and a map and stages. He had stage one for beginning yeshiva Baba, stage two for more advanced, stage three for Ben Aliyah Bala Veda, stage four for a whole heck of the world. It gave me a tremendous sense of knowing there's a structure and stages. The Masos Yesharim, which is probably the primary work of Musa, is a work built on a sulam, on a ladder. I mean, Calvinistic rungs are very far apart for us. I mean, from Zerizus to Zerizus to Zerizus to Zerizus to Nikias is a tremendous span. But it's there. And ironically, not ironically, but I probably that's the reason why Revolver calls a safer safe of Hadracha. The word Hadracha, which means guidance in Hebrew, means Moshe Derech. It is a road. You tell a person, these are the problems, these are obstacles, and these are markers of success. You can actually mark these up as success. So the second point is, one is understanding that it's a long, hard, and hot road. And I told this person who had this issue with your brother, I said, this is your lifetime of Avodah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give you 120 years to go from a horrendous feeling of non-existence in your brother's limelight to understanding your self-value. It's not an Avodah for a month, it's not an Avodah for a year, not even a decade. That seems to be the single most significant fact in your life. And it takes 120 years to work it out. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a life for. Don't worry about the length. And it takes tremendous amount of thought to map out bits and pieces of each and every one. My Rebbe Reb Chaim Shulevitz used to say that whenever we speak about neshama and a guf, we tend to say the guf is a terrible part, the neshama is published, and beautiful, and so on. The Mishnah in Beglava says, how did Mazikin, shade of demons, come into the world? HaKadosh Baruch Hu had neshamas that he did not have a chance to give them a book. And the time is to say, a neshama without a book in this world is a mazik, it's a khurb. It's not, the book is a vehicle that allows it to navigate this world. In other words, and the time was alluding to this, an unbridled idealism that doesn't have any sense and seichel and understanding of where it's navigating. It's like somebody driving with a map and not looking at the road. It's bound to crash. And understanding the Metzius is very much part of it. And there's one more mimer from Butna I would like to repeat that I think is very relevant. It's his first letter printed up in his letters. It was written in 1920. And he says, he who has great ideals in his heart, or his, the Hebrew would probably be more correct, someone whose heart beats with great ideals, but does not understand how to realize them in day-to-day life, is like someone who has a very large coin, and he can't make use of it because nobody's going to change it. It's like somebody walking out with a $1 million check. It's basically useless. Nobody's going to take a $1 million check. If you don't know where to cash it, it's a useless instrument. So having that without it is not useful. There's a Gemara in Chulin. It's an agarata, and the Gemara says it's a very strange description of a certain bird. Rabbi Yehuda said, Koas is a type of bird mentioned in the Torah as being the hummingbird, Zuhakuf. Rachem, there's a bird called Rachem, Zushrakshrak. Shrakshrak is, I don't know what type of bird it is, but it whistles a lot. The word Shrakshrak means to whistle, to be chirp a lot. Amr Yehuda, Lama Nikra Shmoy Rachem, why is it called Rachem? When you hear the bird chirping, it's announcing that there's Rachman coming to the world. As an aside, the Mashal asks over here, why is it a hummingbird if this is what he does? Amar Rabbi Abaye, Rabbi Abaye said, no, it's not always true. Vehu, the Yosef Amidi, the Ovid structure. If it's resting on something and then it's chirping, then it's a psura brachmi. Ugmiri, and we've learned, the Yosef Aharav, if it sits on the ground, Mashara, also the Sheikh of Mashiach will come, Shinema, Asharkalahem, Bakat, say the song. So, it's one of these Gemaras that is very, very veiled. We don't know exactly what it is. But I think there's a certain sense over here that is very much on line with what we're saying. A bird is always seen as being flighty, airy, it's something that's not really connected with the Metzius. On the one hand, a bird is a symbol for Ruchnius. Tzipora is called Tzipora, and the Maral explained that Tzipora is light. Klal Yisrael is a Tzipora of Vassar. It says that symbolizes Klal Yisrael because it's kind of light. There's something very, very ethereal about it. That's one thing. On the other hand, the flip side of it is it's not connected. Birds chirping is an empty type of sound. It's a light sound. It's not something that's solid. So the shrak is called the whistler. It's called the chirper. That's the mehusar bird. And it doesn't mean anything unless it's sitting on something. In other words, unless it's somewhat connected, then it's a sign for Achim. But if it were ever to sit on the ground, if it ever had its 2 feet on the ground, that's when it's a simon for Mashiach, for Geula. When Chazal wanted to portray demons, it says they look like people, but their feet are like chickens. In other words, they're not solidly rooted in the Metzius. Like we said from Chaim, a neshama without a roof becomes a masi. So let's recap the points that we've made. There is, in teaching, the kids are coming from the so-called real world. And the job of the teacher is to paint an ideal to bring them up. We're supposed to uplift them. We're supposed to bring them to higher than what their bodies are, what their metzius is. But on the other hand, in a Torah, in their hearts, in their hearts, in Torah, just to instill and inspire a she'ifa for something ideal without relating it to the real world is not accomplishing much, and sometimes even worse. And therefore, you must understand also something about the realities of the world. I must make a remark: in some ways, boys have it easier than girls with this, because the Gemara, the part of the Torah that's Musar, deals usually with the ideal. Gemara is you spend a lot of time. Okay, so if he says this and you say that, is he lying? Is he lying? What does he get? Why should he get it? Why should he not get it? There is a certain sense that the Gemara does build in a chinuch to things that are real. But be it as it may, every child, unless there's an understanding of realities, understanding different relationships, what's right in which setting, and so on, is a very important part of it. And it's a difficult tension, because how do you keep balancing in painting the world that's kul tov, the yotze kul nuch ha'alamim, and the world we're in? Two, the children need to have a map, and they need to understand. The first thing they need to understand is the road to accomplishment is not one lesson, not two lessons. It's a lifetime of avodah. Like a 12 years, 120 years, that's what's needed to accomplish. One day less is not effective. Whatever we needed out is to take care of it. And the Mela, understanding that there are the real big things, Kina and Kusha and Hesed, all those things are lifetime works. And that's why a person who's a Zuckin is so much more developed. Third of all, we need to put some effort into thinking about trying to give stages. You know, when we talk about Kina, we talk about Hesed, when we talk about any other Midah Tova and anything else that we want to teach, try to understand. Give little sukkos, piece by piece by piece, and so that the child has a sense of this is an accomplishment. For me, if I'm born in such a difficult situation, step 8 is an accomplishment. It really is. It's a little peak. There's a peak after that, but it's a peak. It's a mountain that I climb, and it's a stage in our body. This I prepared before a while back when we was talking about what we should speak. Hashkocha put it that we should come out during the shiva of the Newberger's kind of bracha, and I didn't really know other people until I came here. When I came here, I went and introduced myself 10 years ago. He was extraordinarily warm to me and very, very, it helped me in many ways, a lot of chachma, a lot of practical ways. He felt, and on the other hand, he felt over the yeshiva a lot, those were the 3 years of his life that he felt really changed his life. Being in the mirror, the zoo was the one who showed him a lot of Adarach HaChaim. But I could not think of a talk more appropriate with Zichrei, with Yilui Nishmasai, than this talk. If there's somebody I think that represented this combination of Torah and Darkness and the way we're talking about, of having ideals and the real meshed together, of being as politically astute as can be, and as financially sharp as can be, and navigating using all of those talents and abilities and connections in front of everything for one goal, he was the extraordinary good man. And as Chazal said, when he was the structure of the door, I think, that sat at 2 feet on the ground, his mind and his she'ifos were told and Torah, and his reality that was able to navigate it. And it's not only that he used his chachma and his connection and everything for Torah, the way he did it was also Kiddush Shemayim. You know, he was smart and astute, but never devious. He was strong-willed, strong-minded, never abrasive. It was the way itself, the role itself, carried some of that fragrance of the gold. And I think that that's something that we lost. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary combination. And it's something that goes, I think, at the heart of what we're all doing. And in as much as we keep up the quality of the bird and feet on the ground together, that's the hard work.
Rabbi Lovinsky is willing to answer questions. We thank you very much. Something to think about. Are there any questions? If I may ask,
yeah,
you the question. Are you saying that there are some stories that we should not tell our class?
I think, okay. Let me put it. I don't think that there's such a thing as it being safety. If the story is too frum, you know, but in our mind, if the story carries negative elements, we think about it and possibly reject it. If it's purely positive, then you don't feel wrong in rejecting it. I don't think that's correct. I told somebody once, myself as a buffer, someone told me a story, true or not true, that the Shagasari learned Shas 1,000 times a day. I have some story of that nature. I told him, I want to tell you two things. First of all, that story is absolutely meaningless to me. If you tell me that my chavrusa learned Shas twice, that'll get my juices churning. But the Shagasari learned it 1,000 times, that's why it's the Shagasari, that's why I'm me. That doesn't really mean anything. And it's also, is it right a child is being told that in this situation, the Aaron HaKohen gave it up? But is that the lesson that this child should know? Is it right or not? And there is no such thing as safe if it's too good. Too good is also not safe. That I do mean to say. And obviously, we're humans, and we don't have time to weigh and sift every story, but at least have the idea that the goals have to be real, and they have to be what's appropriate for the kid. And if it's an ideal, at least he understands where it's going to. I once read Rav Chol Noach Kozlovsky is the latest one of the Rebbe's Ben Brother. He's an extraordinary person, man of great stature. I was privileged to have some guests up to some petition. I used to speak to him occasionally. I saw him come to the son-in-law, and we have some over here. And he would tell the Rebbeim the following, he's a great mechanic. He told them the following balance in terms of the content of learning. A lesson should be on the children's level, except for, like, I'm a young kid, you could say something that's a step above them. And he said it's an appropriate combination, because learning means what you understand, and the knowledge that there's something better than that, something higher than that. And he was saying you need to do it, but the balance has to be something within the realm of where they're holding, and occasionally a spark of a world that's higher. I think that's it.
Yes, please.
Go to a sugya? The difficulties of learning, you could tell them at first. One of the things that made a profound impression on me, spurred me to learning, was that at a stage when I was young and learning was dry and not interesting, I heard from somebody who was a big masmi. I overheard a conversation. This person was